Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Don't be ridiculous.
Welcome, friends, to Perfect Stranger Things, a weekly dance of joy for your eardrums. Today, Steve and I cover Papa, the penultimate episode for Season 4. Nancy gets out of the Vecna Vision, Eleven gets out of the Nina Project, and Dr. Brenner gets a bullet to the chest. But first, a bromide from your favorite cow bro. That's right, it's Mr. Wilford Brimley.
You got a story in here. It's the damnest story you ever read. Tell you what we're going to do. We're going to sit right here and talk about it. Now, we'll talk all day if you want it.
It's the right thing to do.
Steve, we're covering Papa, wherein we see the, I think, ultimate demise of Dr. Brenner. You think he's dead? You think this is it?
I mean, I didn't see him get buried. I mean, like, he could have missed the most important part of the heart, maybe.
At least he wasn't shot in the hair.
Yeah, well, he couldn't be, right? I mean, that's... one, I don't think a bullet could penetrate it. That's the first and most obvious.
Not be physically possible to shoot.
And secondly, it's one thing I learned from the film Unforgiven with Clint Eastwood. When there's that conversation about, like, kind of that dual conversation when, like, you're face to face with greatness, like,
sure.
There's something like almost inherently you can't.
Uh-huh.
Like, you could, like, it almost renders the person indestructible, right? Because there's something that happens psychologically in that moment.
So you're saying that Brenner's hair is akin to royalty, is what you're saying.
It's what I'm saying. I'm saying that the guy couldn't have had a headshot if he wanted to. The rest of him was up for grabs.
This is the Robocop failsafe we were talking about?
That's his failsafe, yeah. And that's just built in all of us. And I think that's probably what happened when Eleven tried to use her powers on him initially. I think if you look at that scene carefully, he does something where he puts his head, like, not down to look, make eye contact with her, but puts it forward so that all she can really see is that coif. And so she tries as she might. Good luck.
It's the coif shield. Okay, so Steve, I don't know if you know this, but this is the episode where we jump the shark. Are you prepared to jump the shark with me?
Yeah, let's go. I mean,
okay.
So I'm curious to see. Yeah. Maybe I missed it. I mean,
so I've identified 5 storylines in this very long episode, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm using an 8-sided die. Why, you might ask? Well, because one of these is a Gucci. If we roll an 8, we got ourselves a Gucci, and this podcast ends. But I've also incorporated 2 moons into this podcast.
Oh, finally.
These are just adjacent topics that touch us personally. And this was a suggestion to us from one of our faithful listeners.
Yeah. Do we, can a moon undo a Gucci, or is a moon just out there?
I think a moon is a separate entity from a Gucci. Are you suggesting, like, maybe if we rolled a Gucci and then if we happened to roll a moon, you shoot the moon and then it would nullify the Gucci?
Well, you could choose, right? I think that's, I mean, I don't know all these rules, and I'm sure somebody's going to chime in. God bless them if they do. But I would think that you could then, okay, so you roll a Gucci and you're like, okay, well, typically this is where it would end, but we know that there are moons out there. And so if you roll a moon, you have like two shots, right, to roll a moon, I would think, you know.
Good idea.
And then if you get the moon, you have the option to use the moon in the fashion that it was intended, or you can undo the Goocher, right? You send the Goocher back through the gate. And it doesn't mean that the Goocher's gone forever, obviously.
Like I said, absolutely jumping the shark here.
But then if you have two, let's say you roll moons prior to a Goocher, you can make a choice and say, okay, let's just follow the moon, or we can table the moon. We can put the moon, you know, we could set it aside in the event that a Goocher does come up. We can use it for that. However, if we do not use the Goocher, if the Goocher never comes up and we go through every storyline, that moon is now rendered useless. That's called banking the moon, as far as I'm concerned.
This is the Jennifer edition of Perfect Stranger Things.
And she's listening to this right now. You can't bank a moon. What is he doing?
All right. So just to be clear, we could just read the five storylines and be done with this podcast.
Certainly could.
But I've chosen to incorporate one Goocher and two moons into this whole scenario, and then, of course, add five other rules about banking moons and Goochers.
Yeah, and then there's the Christopher Cross situation where we get caught between the moon and Goocher City.
What would be the best way forward in that case?
That's clear, Anthony. This is the best. Well, I don't know if this is the best possible scenario, but I think the best that you could do,
me,
is fall in love.
Oh, I can do that. Okay, well, let's go ahead and get going.
I don't think
we
have any more time for this podcast, but really appreciate everybody listening.
Okay, here we go.
What if we made the whole podcast out of a Goocher?
Okay, we got ourselves a number three. I always love it when my least favorite thing comes up first, because it's sort of like, could just be a three and a Goocher, and that's it.
Right.
All right, this is the Russia plot. Hopper and Joyce. Hopper and Joyce.
Here we are. We've been waiting for it to redeem itself.
I'd love to see a Goocher and then us try to get a moon twice and just nothing's happening.
Yeah, that's even worse, right? It's Russia, Goocher, no moon. Good night, everybody.
The Russia plot. Hopper and Joyce reconnect while the Demogorgon wrecks shop. Hopper searches the facility, finds a vivisected Demogorgon, and several more in Bacta tanks, and a jarred smoke baby. Then the group escapes Shawshank style. They lean on Yuri to fly them to America. Hopper tries to contact Owens's goons and waits in the Orthodox Church. So, Steve, when we were doing Game of Thrones, you were very disconcerted by the smoke baby that came out of Melisandre's vagina.
Yes.
Did you feel the same way about this smoke monster?
Well, since we didn't know exactly where it came from, I was I was cautiously optimistic.
And I am assuming it's a baby, just because there were a bunch of other sort of baby demi-dogs in Bacta tanks, right?
So you think that these are like test tube?
And also, you've got Jack and Hagar in this scene. I'm just assuming this is a smoke baby.
just fully take. I mean, you know, we're dealing with other dimensions. Why can't we crossover to other series from other networks?
Exactly. And we have Bacta tanks in this.
Right, so we have Disney Plus in here, we've got HBO Max.
The entire landscape's Netflix, a little bit like Hoth, so.
Yeah. If we could only bring in something from a Hulu original, said nobody.
Okay, I have questions about this smoke baby, because we really didn't get to see, and spoilers, we're jumping ahead to the season finale here, but we didn't really get to see Hopper sort of find a weapon that could only be used or find a little bit of information that is going to be useful in Hawkins.
Well, that's what we assume, right? Because it didn't manifest itself.
Yeah, it didn't pay off. In other words, it's and so that's my question. There's got to be something about this particular smoke baby that comes into the final season, right?
It has to. I mean, they spent way too much time staring at it.
They're just staring at it, and then we never see it again, and except for it escapes, right?
Right.
So it's almost like, by the laws of storytelling, it has to come back into the story somehow.
Right. And the fact that it didn't later suggests that it's even later than that, right?
Right. So I think we have our first theory crafting for season 5.
Well, and what's interesting there, right, as we're dealing with it, we're dealing with the penultimate episode of season 4, and season 4 is the penultimate season to season 5, mm-hmm. which will be the... So we kind of get... It's a penultimate within a penultimate.
Well, you just ruined one of my moons. I was just going to have you say penultimate 6 times.
Okay, well, we have 4 more opportunities.
All right, okay. All right, keep going.
So there's... Which I think is part of what helps us hopefully hang on to the cautious optimism we've had with the Russia plotline,
mm-hmm.
Because there is a sense of like, oh, so really was it just sort of just to buy time between the eventual L Hopper reunion?
Yeah, it's interesting.
It does feel like because you go through, and again, spoilers to obviously to the final episode, but I mean, because it doesn't, and because it kind of like feels like a little bit like a huh, and the way that the series or the season ends, it's very clear. It's like, there's a lot more to come. Obviously, we know that, and we feel that way probably more so in this season than we have any mm-hmm. prior.
Interesting that I think that we both probably agree that this is as strong as season 1, maybe even stronger at points in season 1. And yet, I think fundamentally it is a setup season for the final season.
Yeah, whereas every other one feels like it could sort of wrap up. I mean, you always have the horror wink and nod at the end of,
does feel like we have some resolution. I mean, usually you'd get...
Yeah, yeah.
We've gotten less resolution in this season than we've gotten in any of the 3 prior.
Yeah, because all the other ones could end. Like, if the season doesn't get picked up, you at least go, well, that was a nice story, and hey, maybe there's more of that story to be told for them. And mm-hmm. like some horror does that, right? It gives you a hint of something else, and then maybe that's the last you ever see of it, and that's kind of the way it ends, right? Like you're never really out of the dark, right? And that's fine. But this one doesn't do that. This one feels like, oh, this, we just watched Volume 2. Well, let's watch Volume 3.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So this is an interesting episode in that we lose Brenner. So one of our big baddies, it's taken off the board.
And there's a lot of baddies in this.
There's a lot season. Of baddies. But then, of course, we reintroduce a baddie from a previous season, and that being whatever. I guess this is a Mind Flayer kind of smoke monster. If it isn't the Mind Flayer, it is at least sort of Mind Flayer adjacent.
It's like a Mind Flayer skin tag.
It's a really bold statement to put perfect in front of your podcast name. I think that we've demonstrated why we have such hubris. A Mind Flayer skin tag. You're not getting this from any other podcast, I can guarantee you.
Your move, bald move.
I love it. Did you feel that Brenner's exit, assuming this is his exit from the narrative, do you think this was a good conclusion to this guy's story arc?
I do. I think that the little doggy bark. I feel like the he's having a little nightmare. I feel like the closure is good in some sense, because if you look at him like being killed by sort of the monsters he created, that's sort of what we thought anyway, or at least the monsters that he facilitated in season 1. That was all fine and well, we thought. I think that there's, because of the story now with the depth of the story of with Elle and Papa. We needed closure. She needed closure, right? And I think that becomes a very complicated ending. And I think it was really good that we didn't get a redemption arc from him per se. and that she got the last word. I think that was, to me, that was fairly satisfying. Like, I think it was interesting. He saves her, right? But, and that's kind of been his MO. He always thinks he's saving her. And then at the end, he's just like, well, I want you to know that, you know, what I was doing. But, like, can you at least agree that I had your best interest in mind? And she's just like, peace out, Papa.
I was a little underwhelmed with this ending.
Okay.
I think you're right. I think that this is more about what this does for Elle's character than it does for his character. Way back at the beginning when we got the first, you know, 8 minutes of the show, I was a little bit worried that they were going to try to make him into a morally gray character rather than just sort of a, you know, fully evil mad scientist. And I think that they did that to a certain extent. You're right. There was no sort of salvation at the end. It wasn't like he like turned his life around in a way that seems meaningful or anything like that. But I think that go ahead.
Well, and I think that there were teases to that, and I think that's why I was satisfied.
Right.
He unlocks the
I would have been disappointed if they tried to redeem him in such a way that I you know, forgot about all the times when he was torturing children. I'm glad they didn't do that. I do think that's kind of like the rolling around on the dirt in the desert, and I don't know. There's just something about his death that just kind of fell flat for me. And I think it maybe helps me a little bit to hear you talk about how this is sort of a way for Elle to finally understand his motivations and then ultimately think, I don't have to give you what you're asking for here. I'm walking away.
And that is a real big moment, because I feel like we see that, and it's drawn out throughout her return to Brenner, is does she have Stockholm syndrome? Is she so desperate for family that really at the end of the day, she is such a different person, you know, cause that's the whole thing, is she a monster? Is she a superhero? But regardless of whether she's a monster or a superhero, she's not like everybody else. Mm-hmm. And the only person that might be able to truly be a father figure for her is someone who understands her, at least at some level, even if it's accepting her as a monster.
Well, and, fundamentally, he's an abusive father, right? And of course,
right.
She's a teenager at this point. I just think for him and his character in his own right, there was something about him flopping around in the desert that didn't work for me.
Okay. See, I guess the thing that kind of worked for me is because in the midst of all this action and craziness, and there is sort of a logical buildup to like, he's going to go in a way that's going to be grand fashion, right? That we all could be like, oh, Elle is set free. And like, mm-hmm. But what happens is he kind of goes out with a whimper. I mean, it's a pretty big deal, everything that's going on around him. All of his grand plans are crashing down around him, right? I mean, he's not being killed by a monster. From another dimension, he's being killed by the carnage, essentially, that he's brought forth in the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, all he's out there in the desert. There's something sort of, you know, poetic about a desert in that case. He's just all by himself. He's alone. Wreckage around him. All of his work is basically just up in smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And all he can have one last thing is, can one remaining part of his work acknowledge that at least on some level, maybe it was worth it.
And he doesn't even ask for forgiveness. He asks for understanding.
Yeah, yeah.
I've only ever wanted to help you. To protect you. Everything I did for you. I need you to understand. Please tell me you understand.
I just need you to understand. And it's just wonderful. She's not going to give him that. She's just going to look at him and walk away.
Yeah. And that's a real big deal. I mean, it's almost like he came up with a negotiation. Hey, can we just do this? Can you just acknowledge the understanding of it? Like, maybe you can at least see where I was coming from. And she's just like, no, you know, and I think that the way she does it is not, it's, there's almost just a hint of sweetness, like almost like there's this touch of like pity. I think it wraps up pretty nice for me. I didn't feel... I think if I had had a Sullivan shoots him himself, or a monster gets him, or L rips him apart, I don't think I would have had that same, you know, or one, you know, somehow he gets thrown in, meets one, you know. I think there's something even more, like, even one doing it gives him too much of a ending that he deserves, right? I mean, I think there's something about the loneliness. There's something about, like, none of this meant anything when it comes down to it for you. Like, whatever you were trying to do, you won't even get to see how this thing closes out.
So the other thing that we were worried about at the very beginning, or at least I was worried about, is that if they're going to humanize Brenner in a way that they did in this season, and I think that they did this to a certain extent, are they also going to render Eleven a morally gray character, which I wasn't happy with. So she's not the murderer that caused the massacre of Hawkins Labs, but there was that moment where she said, if you try to get in my way, I will kill you. And then, of course, he does try to stop her, and I got the sense that she was going to kill him. She levitated him just like Vecna levitates. And then the only thing that stops her from killing him, at least this is how I'm reading it, is that the drugs kick in and she passes out. So I'm wondering if we do see a tiny bit of gray matter in this character.
Well, let me ask you this question in a way. If she was facing Vecna in that same situation, would you think that she was morally gray for trying to kill him?
Yeah, no, I mean, I have seen her snap necks before, right?
Right. I'm just saying, but in terms of, like, I think what's happening in the show is that it's okay to look at Brenner as not a human villain.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
If we're talking monsters versus superheroes, I had a real moment where I was like, you know, this is, you know, what do you always hear people say? What's the, like, people are like, Frankenstein was the doctor, not the monster, right? But in this case, I think you're like, well, no, who really was the monster in the story of Frankenstein? It is Frankenstein. It is Dr. Frankenstein. So it's just that we associate the monster being named Frankenstein, but it's the person who is playing with life and is playing with essentially creating ambiguous purpose for their own sake, right? That becomes the monstrous action. And so in this case, look, there's no Vecna without Brenner.
Well, and he's a monster. I mean, we've seen him act monstrously in a number of ways, right? So,
I mean, he's engineering Owens getting beat up and basically saying, look, I'll kill Owens if you don't do what I say. But he's still trying to play it off like he's got her best interest in mind. Like, and then that's his final words to her, essentially, are like, hey, you know, I did this for you, kind of thing. And it's like, you can't, this has to run out at some point. You can't just continue. I mean, that, and so if you really want to look at it, if that is his quote monstrousness, he was a monster to the bitter end.
All right, let me ask you a question. All right, so let's agree that he's a monster. If we see Eleven levitate Dr. Brenner, break his legs, and suck his eyeballs out, just like Vecna does, don't you start to think, that was a little bit brutal? You know, that's what villains do in this story.
Sure.
So I got that sense. I was sort of, it was almost like she was right on the border of crossing a line there. And she didn't go over, so maybe that's her salvation. We've talked about the theme of salvation before, right? But it was that they did a little bit. They've been playing with season. Like, is she the monster? Is she the superhero? She realizes she's not the monster, that he's the monster. But then at the end of it, she's willing to kill the monster, right? And there's a sense in which you got to become a monster to kill a monster.
Yeah, or the question is it morally gray to kill a monster that's out there trying to, you know, I mean, at what point are monsters irredeemable? And if it was a mind flayer, if it was a demidog, if it was Vecna himself, we would all be like, no, snap it, snap it, snap it, snap it. But because of his gorgeous hair and because
the hair is confusing me.
That's right. Because he looks like us and he talks like us and he walks like us, well, he can't be that much of a monster. Or he can't be as much of a threat as some of these other monsters. And so that's where I kind of feel like, well, and there's two things. I don't necessarily, I mean, if she had done it maybe in that brutalized fashion, like if she had gone Vecna style, then maybe there is that moment of like, they're closer than you think, which I think is good storytelling. And then the other side of it is that the Duffers maintain that ambiguity to some degree, because we don't know what she would have done. Like, she may have snapped his neck. She may have just held him there. We don't know what would have happened. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, the beauty of it is that says, look, why should Elle be any less morally gray than any other person on the planet? To suggest that we're not all morally gray to some degree is, I think that's a little bit.
Well,
folly.
No, I agree with all that. I'm just saying that in this particular story,
the more powerful you are, the more of a threat you could be.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on all that. I'm saying in this particular story, at least with season one of Stranger Things, it was sort of a good guys versus bad guys scenario. That's the story that they were telling. They weren't really telling a story that had morally gray character. Maybe I take that back. Hopper was a bad cop.
Hopper was a bad
cop. He was a dirty cop, for sure.
To your point, Elle was snapping necks without even wondering if that was a...
Yeah, all right, okay.
Breaking kids' arms, man.
Okay, I rescind it all.
It's time for you to grow up the same way that the show has, okay?
And that is how we conclude this...
Our friendship.
I hope you've enjoyed this. You've seen the friendship run its course. No, Steve, that is that's us covering the Russia plot, just so you know. that's how much we were thrilled with the Russia plot, is that we just spent the last 20 minutes talking about the Brenner 11 plot.
We just filibustered the Goocher.
Okay, I'm going to roll this thing.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Got ourselves a 6, which is first moon. It's moon number
and
1.
By the way, if you roll a 3 again, we still have to do the Russian plot. There's a helicopter. And you and I are moved by helicopters.
There's more than one helicopter in this episode.
Yeah. I mean, helicopters like Blue Thunder, and I remember even the helicopter in Riptide. Helicopters mattered, especially in the 80s, so I really appreciate it.
Well, TC's helicopter.
Oh, yeah.
Magnum PI. Malcolm and the PI.
That's why don't we more crossovers where Frankie Muniz has a mustache.
This is number 6. We got ourselves a moon.
All right, do we want to bank it or do we want to go for it?
You want to hear what the question is first before we bank it?
I don't know if you could do that. I think you have to choose to bank.
Well, I already know what it is.
Oh, so what do you want to do?
I'm going to read you the moon, and then you can decide.
Is your question dumb?
You
can bank it.
You'll find out. All right, this is a question for you, Steve. Have you ever had a feeling of being haunted, seen a ghost, Ooh. Or had an encounter with something unexplained?
Oh, okay.
Now, do you want to answer this? Or you want to bank this?
I don't. I think we're going to play Richard. That's how relevant I am. I wanted to make a Family Feud reference, and rather than going Steve Harvey, I went Richard Dawson because I wanted to be, you know, sensitive to the time frame with which we're dealing with.
Very good, very on brand. So, what is your decision? Are you banking this moon?
We're gonna play. Let's play.
We're gonna play. Okay, Steve, have you ever had a feeling of being haunted, seen a ghost, had an encounter with something unexplained?
Yes. All right. Roll again. This was fun.
Say more.
Have you? I mean, you wrote the question.
I have, in fact.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. No. There was a house that I bought with my family, and I had actually had a dream about it before I ever went and saw it. And when I went to look at the house.
Wait. This is you as an adult, and you bought a house.
Yeah. Okay. So when we went to go look at the house, and we were looking at the property, and we were like, oh, this is really fun, it's really exciting. I remember, apparently I didn't tell my wife or my kids this until like after we moved out, that I had, I'm like, oh yeah, when we did the walkthrough, I was like, oh, I dreamt about this house like a few weeks prior. I remember I was standing here, there was actually stairs coming down, or there were no stairs where the stairs are currently. And I was going to the door, which is the door that would go into our bedroom from outside, and a cold, dead witch's hand touched my shoulder. And as I turned around, all I saw was like kind of like a silhouetted dark figure, and I woke up immediately. And they really wished I would have said that because that house, I mean, Heather had, she would wake up in the middle of the night saying that she saw a dark figure standing over her and pointing at her, to the point where she's like, woke me up in the middle of the night.
Well, can I just mention that I don't care how old you are, or if you're dead or not dead, pointing is just rude. You don't do that, even if you're a specter. Can I just...
Here's the thing about being a specter and pointing. It doesn't matter where you're pointing. I'm freaked out. You're pointing at me, I feel like you're either threatening me or you're blaming me. If you're pointing to the right, I'm like, something's to the right. I'll never go to the right.
Never go to the right again.
Yeah, I mean, she could be, that specter could be like, well, no, go that way. You need to leave that way. And I'm like, I'm not, unless you're going to write something down, never, I'm hanging a Louie all the time. And so, yeah, and our kids would, like, wake up.
So you had a premonition about the house. It happened in a dream, and the house ended up being haunted.
Well, the kids said that they felt, like, bugs crawling on them at night, and they would hear things. I mean, yeah, okay. So the guy that owned the house before died in that house, all right?
That's not true.
But that was, yeah, for sure.
Oh, this is fantastic.
Yeah. And then
was I ever in this house?
Oh, yeah. You spent the night there.
Is this the house that we played Scrabble and I got too drunk to go home?
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's why we chose
Scrabble. I was probably haunted too, but I was too drunk to remember it.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you broke the spell because you passed out with your boots on.
And I think I slept in your beanbag.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, that's a whole other story.
Yeah, so no, I thought
now, here's my question.
Am I the worst father?
You think Heather was more upset about the ghost or with me?
Yeah, well, she was pretty mortified by the ghost, but she won't talk about the ghosts now. Oh. She'll still talk about you.
Mm-hmm.
And the night you ruined Thanksgiving. Or...
Look, you put a Scrabble board in front of me. There's just no telling what's going to happen.
Right. There was a live chicken involved at one point that night, if I recall correctly.
All right. I'm rolling this thing. All right. This is.
Wait, you don't have any. Wait, you're not going to. We're just going to find out what a terrible father I was.
Maybe that'll be a moon for a later for another episode. Yeah. This is the Scooby-Doo Gang Part 1. Nancy's Vecna vision continues. Meanwhile, the Scooby-Doo gang frantically searches for music that Nancy might like. Eddie holds up an Iron Maiden cassette and yells, "This is music." Meanwhile, Vecna tells Nancy to tell Eleven everything she's seen in her vision. Then he releases her. Nancy wakes up in the arms of Steve Harrington. Later on, Nancy tells more of her vision to the gang. Vecna, it seems, showed Nancy a future wherein Hawkins was overcome by monsters. The gang surmises that the fourth kill will open up a fourth gate and begin an end-of-the-world situation. They devise a plan to kill Vecna while he is defenseless and by using Max as bait. This answers immediately one of the questions that we had about the Nancy salvation song.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't need one. Vecna just let her go.
Yeah.
I was a little disappointed. I was like, I wanted to see what song was going to save Nancy.
So, yeah. So that whole sequence is really vexing because why does Vecna call his own shot? Why do all of them?
Well, I got the sense that he's trying to lure Eleven.
Yeah, there's something, I feel like there's something else, though, and maybe, you know, this is where, because of how this season ends, where I'm like, is Vecna several steps ahead? Did the way that things unfold in the next episode, which seemed to be maybe not working out for him as much, was that part of the grander plot?
Do you think he's got all this well in hand?
If we take Papa at his word, which is, you know, not easy to do at this point, right?
Well, Papa don't preach.
Yeah, well, he did in this one. He said, "You're not ready." The Empire Strikes Backed it, right?
That's right. There's a lot of Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, she's not ready. She's not strong enough. So if you look at it from one perspective, Vecna having these conversations, getting into Nancy's head, doing these things, but keeping in the same way that we will see that Max uses herself as bait, is Vecna using himself as bait and the kids as bait so that she doesn't get as strong as she needs to be? Like, is that a possibility, right?
He's trying to get her to not complete the training. Come to try to save the friends in Cloud City before she's ready. And maybe she's not strong enough to face him.
Like, it's a bit of a rope-a-dope.
Interesting.
Just throwing things out there. I'm just throwing things against the wall, right?
Yeah, now. I think that there's something to that. There's also the other thing that interests me about this vision is that, number one, they don't show us everything. Nancy has to explain what she said. I had to actually rewind it to think there's a lot she's mentioning that I didn't see in that vision. But she, you know, she's talking about horrible things happening to her mother and her brother and her sister. She clearly doesn't care about Ted.
No, at all. I mean, that was, talk about, wow, I think we're setting up the villain for the next season.
Do you think she even knows Ted exists?
I'm wondering if only we can see Ted.
So there's that part of it. And then there's the part of it how he showed her the future. And we know that they're playing with time stuff, right?
Right.
Did he show her the future or did he show her a possible future?
Well, it seems like it was a possible future, right? Because when my understanding is when the earthquake and everything happens and the upside down opens up, that's when her family is whatever specifically happens, it happens to him.
Hmm.
And it suggests that it almost seems like it didn't quite happen that way. Like we only got a glimpse of it. Unless I need to probably go back and do a rewatch, but I know it's obviously not over yet, but you know, so maybe she was seeing multiple timelines, like, you know, as it goes along. But, I almost got the sense that like the plan worked ish.
Interesting. Well, yeah, if we fast forward to the next episode, right?
Yeah, we see mom and sister and Ted.
I want to mention, got an email from Kristen, and Kristen said that it would be great as if Nancy's song was Journey Separate Ways.
Mm.
Now, Kristen did not get what she asked for. She really wanted the Separate Ways because she thought it would work really well for the Steve and Nancy plot. You know, they still love each other. It is a 1983 song, so that would fit as well.
It's a banger. It's an absolute banger.
It's a fantastic song. And unfortunately, we didn't get that, so Kristen didn't get that at the beginning of the episode, but we absolutely get that song at the end of the episode.
Right, in a very haunting style, too, yeah. Which I was all about. And here's the thing, that what I think is wonderful for me, anyway, is I like that song quite a bit. I find it very catchy, very entertaining, possibly one of the most awkward music videos of all time. Please, just put a note, stop the podcast for a bit, watch that video. It's incredible. And I mean, and talk about earnest. This band is earnest in this particular video. What I liked is that had, like I said, not a huge fan of the song. She was like singing along with it as it was going. Like it was the right song at the right time for this household.
It's a fantastic song. This episode had at least three really satisfying needle drops.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Kristen, you didn't get what you wanted at the beginning of the episode, but I hope you enjoyed how this episode ended. And then, of course, the Separate Ways stuff. It does tie into the group splitting up, right?
Right. It does. Yeah, exactly. And I think it kind of also helps, too. It sets up like the split of Hawkins that we're going to eventually see.
Yeah. Yeah, good. So I also wanted to note in the storyline that, you know, we've been noting the religious themes in this season. I mean, I think we should probably point out that the four chimes of the clock, which Max recognizes, and the four gates, and then Lucas says the end of the world. And what the group does not say, that it assumes that we will connect the dots, is the four horsemen.
Right.
So I thought that was really well done. I like that sometimes these things are kind of subtly snuck in, and it shows that the Duffers trust a certain amount of intelligence on their audience's part, which I always appreciate.
Well, and I think this is one of the things that works too, is that there are elements of art, of whether it's, you know, however, whatever the medium, where we sometimes don't even realize why it resonates, whereas the four horsemen thing may be something that, while it's not explicitly said, it's part of our, just sort of our consciousness.
Yeah, it's like our cultural matrix. It's in there somewhere.
Yeah. So even without it, without even maybe making the connection, the connection's been made on some level, and that's where the satisfaction of that, like why it works, right? It's, this is all working for me, and I don't even know why, but it's just because it's already in the DNA.
I like that Eddie, we actually got Eddie holding up a Iron Maiden cassette.
Yeah, that was dope.
That was really fantastic. I just to kind of connect the dots here, what was your feeling about the mascot for Iron Maiden.
I always knew the mascot way more than I knew any of the music. I don't think I ever listened to any Iron Maiden.
Yeah, that artwork was like, you know, for me as I don't know, 9-year-old or whatever, that image of Eddie, the skinless Eddie, is kind of burned in my mind.
Yeah.
I always really appreciated that. I always wanted to study the cover art. Not a big Iron Maiden guy, but Eddie is sort of a paramount figure in my imagination.
Well, and I think it was something too that as a kid, you know, looking at it, because it was a representation of something that was, you know, off limits, you know, growing up in a Christian household.
Oh yeah, totally taboo, know, right?
Undead, it's got to be satanic. But if you really look at it, there's a slight cartoonish quality to him
that absolutely
makes him accessible to me. So it really is one of the all-time great, like, it's not necessarily a logo, but in terms of like a mascot or a figure, a visual aid to something, like, there's no question that's Iron Maiden for one thing.
Because Eddie was kind of a cartoon, but we knew that he was not cartoonish.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of felt a little bit like, you know, you're on the cusp of something that you should not, a taboo cultural element.
Right.
You know, this is for adults. This isn't for me.
Yeah, and also, like, it made me want this. He was the Joe Camel of heavy metal. I mean, like, it made me want to explore the music just because I'm like, I would love to have like an Eddie poster or a shirt, but like, if I can't name one song,
sure, man, yeah, sure,
I'm gonna be a poser.
All right, I'm gonna roll this thing. This is a number two.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
For Prestige, me and Aaron are still extending our Shogun Afterglow with part 3 of our discussion of the 1980s TV miniseries. Last week absolutely shocked our sensibilities with Lord Toranaga doing the tango. What delights and horrors will await us this week?
Then for Pulp, this Friday join us for our latest prep session for House of the Dragon Season 2 as we take another look at the key differences between the text of Fire and Blood and the on-screen action for Season 1, and what they mean for the characters, story, and setting. Get your Valyrian steel sharpened for the new season.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, the very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Number two is Scooby-Doo Gang Part 2. Eddie hotwires a Winnebago as Creedence Clearwater Revival serenades their trip to the Army Surplus Store. Then Steve and Nancy share a moment as they imagine a family vacation together. Max tells Lucas that she'll be safe from Vecna if she hides in a happy memory. Once at the Surplus Store, Robin falls in love with Molly Ringwald. And then Nancy is confronted by Jason. Later on, the gang constructs weapons, and then they bond. They drive to the murder house, drop off Max and the Sinclair kids to the tune of Journey's Separate Ways. So I mentioned there's at least three needle drops in this episode that I appreciated. When they steal that Winnebago and Creedence Clearwater drops... oh my gosh, I was so happy. I was so happy. And oftentimes, you didn't do a Creedence Clearwater drop unless it was a Vietnam movie.
Mm. Oh yeah, yeah. No, and where are they? And how are they? Where are they going? And
they're going to the Army Surplus Store, right?
Yeah, so good.
So I thought that was fantastic. Wonderful choice there. And then when they're in the Winnebago on the way, it's James Taylor's Fire and Rain.
Yeah.
And it's Nancy and it's Steve. They're talking with each other. And there's that line, I always thought that I'd see you again. And I thought, one of these two is going to die.
Yeah, it does feel it, huh? Yeah.
And yet, and we should probably talk about it, Steve Harrington comes through unscathed, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, he could still die, but I think we were both convinced that something major was going to happen with Steve by the end of this season.
Yeah. I think a lot of people were. Yeah, and so that isn't... I mean, I don't know if we want to explore that now or discuss that on the next episode.
Yeah, it's probably... You're probably right. You should probably wait for that, for sure. But I was thinking... When I heard Fire and Rain, I thought, "Oh, one of these two is a goner, total."
Yeah,
goner.
And I wonder if all of this is conscious efforts on the showrunners to build that. Because I mean, at that point, I looked over at Heather and she's like, "Don't say it again," because she
she doesn't want it to happen.
She's been like, "Look, I don't believe it. I don't think it's gonna happen." But then the more I, you know, like to the point where I'm like almost rooting for him to die so I can be right.
Do you have birds singing in the background?
Oh, yeah.
This is fantastic. You got dogs running around. You got birds. It's like I'm imagining you in like a Disney forest right now.
Yeah, it's similar. Well, that's a really good. That's really.
That's so nice.
I mean, first off, do you ever have a relationship with a... like a military surplus store?
No, but that's kind of how the flea market, Spassable flea market, functioned for me.
Sure. Well, there was a surplus store in Santa Rosa that I went to a couple times, and I got myself like a cool like Marine hat, so I looked like
like a beret,
G.I. Joe. No, like one of those like little short brimmed mm-hmm. you know, green caps, and. I always liked that.
We could have hung out. I could have wore my captain's hat.
Oh man, we would have been something. Yeah, yeah, we would have been like, because we're not really tough, so we've been like G.I. Josephs.
So this is a gung ho hat you've got.
Yeah, yeah. So I would go in there and I would just be fascinated because it was like it was just, you know, jackets and, you know, memorabilia and, you know, some weaponry obviously. And. And so this episode, to me, probably more so than maybe even was intended, I don't know, like brought me right back to an age and a time because it was that age and time that I would have been going to that mm-hmm, place. Mm-hmm. And so to see it being used for like, you know, for what it was supposed to be used for, which was, you know, to, you know, you're going to go on some sort of adventure. I mean, like having a survival knife and all that kind of stuff was so so important to me for some reason.
This was like a surplus superstore. I mean, this thing was enormous.
And everybody in Hawkins is getting a piece of that action. I love Erica's comment about like wait, we're trying to avoid all these wackos. We're going to go to a military.
Yeah, you want to avoid angry hicks. Maybe we shouldn't go to the army. I was thinking you don't all need to go. You could send one person or two people to go get the stuff. But just to have everyone load into the Winnebago, that was totally worth it for me.
Yeah, then it does feel a little even more Mystery Machine-ish, right? Like now we've really got the Scooby-Doo gang in a proper vehicle. And then the other thing that I really liked was when Eddie dons the Michael Myers mask. And
so he could be
less conspicuous.
Sure.
The music, we talk about music, we talk about the needle drops. It's the score in this particular case, which I always love the score because it always feels properly 80s.
Mm-hmm.
It takes on some Carpenter vibes,
nice.
John Carpenter does his own music and everything. There's a little touch of it in the basic synth sound that is very unique to the John Carpenter style that's going through it. And it was just, it was just making me so happy because it totally was capturing the this is Michael Myers time. And I just thought that was so cool.
This episode I felt a little bit underwhelmed with on first watch. And because I did feel like this is kind of setting up.
Moving the pieces
to knock him down in the next episode. And I think it's supposed to be the climax, I think, is supposed to be the fact that Brenner dies. And that didn't do much for me. But on second watch, I feel like I really, there were just so many parts of this episode that really got me.
Yeah. And since the Brenner death did work for me more, I think that, the helicopter scene alone, I mean, wow.
I like that she's controlling the helicopter. That was really cool.
Yeah.
That was pretty great.
I was all in on the helicopter going down.
I'm going to roll this. We already have a one. Already have a two. Did we have a four? Okay, this is 11 and Company, which we've talked about already a bit. 11 wakes up and demonstrates her Dagobah magic on the Nina tank. Brenner finally explains his history and intentions with 11. Riser shows 11 photos of the Vecna victims, and she worries over her friend's safety. Brenner explains how all of Hawkins is in danger, like the breaking of a dam. 11 projects into the astral plane and spies on the Scooby-Doo gang. 11 wants to return to Hawkins to help her friends. Riser wants to get her back to Hawkins too, whereas Brenner thinks that she's not ready. Before Riser can get her out, there is a major shootout between Brenner's goons and Sullivan's goons. 11 confronts Brenner over his mad scientist bullshit. Brenner drugs 11, collars her, and tries to escape with her. Helicopter sniper takes out Brenner. Then 11 brings down the copter. Mike and company show up, and then they drive off. But before he dies, Brenner releases 11's collar and pleads for her understanding. A lot of Empire Strikes Back in this.
Yeah.
Even down to sort of, lifting the Nina tank.
Mm-hmm.
You can't leave the training's not finished. You could help your friends, but it's really dangerous. All of that stuff is Empire for sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So that's all. And there's a lot of, obviously Star Wars throughout the whole series. But this has been feeling like Empire has been especially key, I think, for all of them. Because, we get Lando references in season one, right?
I've got a question for you about season one. So in 1983... was 11 sent into the astral plane to look for Soviets or to look for Henry?
That part doesn't get closed, right?
Because she basically is accusing Brenner. She's like, you were using me to find Henry. And he's saying, no, we were looking for Soviets. But she's not convinced by this. Mm. And I think that we are kind of been trained to trust her instincts on these things.
Right.
So what do you think the... It seems pretty integral to the plot that they were spying on Russians for season one, right?
Well, here's what I get out of that, right? I get that Brenner has his cake and eats it too. That Brenner is able to, you know, maybe to get funding and to get all that he needs is, yeah, I'll use this, what, quote, technology to spy on the Russians. And what that does is it creates now this Russia plot, right? But he's able to sort of justify what his real intentions are, which are, look, I can also search for, I can use this particular student to help me close this part of what I really am after. Hmm. You know, so you can do both, right? I mean, and
so he's like all scientists with government funding, they are using the funding to accomplish whatever the government wants them to accomplish, but they're also
he can say, yeah, well, we're just spying on Russians. It's like, yeah, you were spying on Russians, but was that what you, because I mean, clearly that was not his intent when this whole project began, right? So we don't necessarily know exactly how those dots connect, how that goes from the project that he set out to the project to become spying on Russians. But it does, to me, feels like, yeah, this is where you get your funding. This is how you can sort of cloak. It's a cloaked mission altogether because it's classified, but then it's further cloaked that, like, hey, look, you can also get away with doing something that might be a little unsavory with this technology. Because what are they going to do? Are they going to call you out on it? Because they're doing something that's already, you know, not exactly above board here at this.
I will say that I was a little bit worried about something like this. And I think that they've done this pretty well. But I'm generally a little suspicious when you try to retcon motivations into previous seasons that I like. Right? So I really like the first season of Stranger Things. And fundamental to the motivations of that character in that first season was, we want to use you as a Russian, you know, to spy on Russians. And it's not a major part of it, but I get a little bit suspicious when you try to retcon stuff.
Well, and that assumes it was a retcon and that this wasn't sort of a map, right? And we don't know that for sure, because, I mean...
We don't know that. I think...
To me, it could, because... Well, they're not going to say, yeah, I'm using you to find a monster child that you sent into the Upside Down. I think we like that show less. because I think we're like, what are you, what?
Yeah, you know? So, I think you're right. I think you're right.
But if you go through the effort that we have now, it's like, oh, he's spying on Russia. Russia's very, that's a very 80s thing to get behind. And I think as an audience, it works for us because he's like, we're like, well, we believe that's what his motivations were. It's like, yeah, that's what everybody believed my motivations were.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, I think we can look back and say, this was not him trying to destroy Henry. This was not him trying to save Henry. This was him trying to continue to study, is what I think, because he can't let it go.
And I think Brenner does feel a certain way about, like, I'm not done with this experiment yet.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't have the mice getting out of the cage.
Yeah, and then I keep L because L's my key to Henry.
I got to get Henry back. I got to get one back. All right, I'm rolling this thing. I already have two. That, my friends, is a Goocher.
Oh, my.
Oh, Jesus, man, that's a Goocher.
Did we go all the storylines?
Steve, the Goocher ends this.
We still have a moon to shoot. We have one moon left to shoot.
We don't look back. You're about to turn into a pillar of salt, my friend.
No, you could shoot the moon, baby. No,
that's true. We did not cover five, which is the Surfer Boy pizza plot. So if you want to, we could roll this again, see if we can get a moon.
We risk nothing.
Okay, let's shoot the moon. Here we go. A seven is indeed a moon. I can't prove it to you people, but I was actually hoping for a Goocher. Because a little bit less editing, but that's how it rolls. This is a moon. This is for you, Steve.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever had a reoccurring nightmare?
All right. So, when I was a kid, when I was very young, there was a movie that came out called Magic. Do you remember this movie?
I do not.
So Magic came out in 1978. This movie stars Anthony Hopkins and Burgess Meredith.
How have I never seen this? It sounds amazing.
And Margaret's in this too. Anthony Hopkins is a ventriloquist.
You've got me already. Got me hooked. I'm going to go watch this right now.
Who has one of the most grotesque looking ventriloquist dummies that gets just, it's this over caricatured like version of him. And it's terrifying. And I remember
seeing...
It's
like a Phil Collins video?
It's pretty close to the spitting image character.
Okay.
And I remember seeing posters and billboards, and just as a three-year-old, I'm like, that's just nightmarish. And I wanted nothing to do with this film. I didn't want it to exist. And my mom... was going to go watch it. And I was like begging her, do not go see this film.
You didn't even want a member of your family to see the film.
I did not. I was like, don't bring this evil upon us. I think she even had the book, when they make a book after a movie. And I think it was, and she had to hide it. Cause if I saw the picture, I would just, I'd flip out. So I started having recurring nightmares about this dummy. And they were horrifying. I was afraid to go to sleep because it wouldn't happen every night. But when it happened, I couldn't get, I couldn't shake it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were dreams where he would just be in my room and then he wouldn't be in my room and then he'd be closer. So those are the kind of how it was. And eventually I had a situation where I, in the dream, it was the first time I ever learned to sort of control a dream, mm-hmm. right, or to navigate in it. And I in the dream, I verbally berated the dummy, telling him he was just a dummy, he was nothing. I mean, I roasted him, I guess. And I remember in the dream, the dummy actually started to cry. And I told him, I never want to see him again. And that was the last time I ever had a dream about him, and that was the first time. And since then, I pretty much am always pretty much aware of the fact that I'm dreaming, and I always usually can navigate and change my dreams.
Huh. You did the whole Bob advice from season two.
Yeah. So that's why. Yeah, it's funny because I remember that being like, "Oh yeah, dude, I get that. I preach it."
All right. So tell me what the rules are now. We nullified the Goocher with a moon, right?
Right.
Did we keep rolling, or is this the end?
That's the end. So what we could have done is we could have used the moon to go to that story.
Oh, yeah, but we didn't do that. So basically, we just made things a little bit more about us.
Yeah. I like what you've done with this podcast. Well, I noticed that you're not answering these questions, so it's really more about
I will.
Me. This is... It's a therapy session.
I will tell you, I did have one reoccurring. Let me say one thing about Jonathan.
These past few months, she's been so lost without you. It's just she's so different from other people, and when you're different, sometimes you feel like a mistake. But you make her feel like she's not a mistake at all. Like she's better for being different, and that gives her the courage to fight on. If she was mean to you or she seemed like she was pushing you away, it's probably just because she's scared of losing you, just like you're scared of losing her. And if she was going to lose you, I think she'd rather just get it over with quick, like ripping off a band-aid. So yeah, Elle needs you, Mike, and she always will. Yeah?
There's a scene where Jonathan is looking through the mirror, seeing Will crying.
Right. Yeah, this is most dramatic, mm-hmm. Personal moment. We finally got it. We're going to be like, yeah, let's talk about Steve's nightmare about a dummy, about an Anthony Hopkins-esque dummy.
I got to go see this movie, man.
It's interesting. Speaking of Cocoons of Horror, for those who haven't, this might be something to take a look-see at.
Oh, we got to mention there's a little animator moment in this episode.
Oh, yeah, reanimator for sure with the pencil.
With the Brenner's the mad scientist, and he's using this pencil as a metaphor, and he breaks it. And we were just talking about a scene very like that in Reanimator on Cocoons of Horror.
Yeah, so, I mean, because Reanimator, you've got, obviously you have the mad scientist. He's, to some degree, he's bringing Elle back to life in terms of her powers. We see some restorative powers in the next episode.
Interesting. All right. Well, we should save that. All right. So, I think I need to change my tune on whether or not Will is into Mike. I just think he's worried about losing his entire friend group if he comes out of the closet. Because we finally got to see the painting, right?
Right. But he lies and says it was commissioned by Elle.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe that's a half lie, or I'm not sure if it's a...
Elle specifically says in the very first part of this season that she's like, he's working on something. I don't know what it is.
That's
I think
right.
It's Burke.
I'm glad you reminded me of that. You're right. So he says it was an Elle commission. So that heart on his shield is sort of doing a lot of heavy lifting for this.
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting. So anyway, I'm not sure if he's into Mike or not. I just feel like maybe he feels like there's something about me. It's a secret. I feel like I can't tell anyone. I don't think Mike's going to understand. And if I do, I'm going to lose my best friend.
Yeah, and the complexity of that goes even further, right? Because, I mean, if whether he's into Mike or not, almost immaterial, he's being truthful. He's like, if there's one person who I do believe that would be on my side or at least be able to see me for who I really am, it's Mike, because Mike does that for Elle. Mike is able to see past what maybe some people would see as making her a freak, and he sees that as special and sees her for what she really is. So if there was anybody here in this group that would have the easiest time seeing that, it would theoretically be Mike. So the feelings he may have for Mike, they don't even necessarily have to be romantic in nature, because there is a closeness and a trust that he is desperate to get, because he sees it being manifested for Mike's relationship with Elle and what that does for Elle, and he desperately wants that sort of acceptance. And,
yeah, this is about, you know, I think this is more about acceptance than it is about attraction. That's how I'm reading this now. And I'll be honest, I think I have a higher opinion of Will now that I know he's not into Mike, because I don't like Mike. I don't think anyone should be into Mike. Right. I forgive Eleven because she was raised in a test tube. I mean, I want Eleven to be happy. If Eleven wants Mike, and I want her to have Mike, I just want to say, well, Eleven, look around. Just look around a little bit. That's all I'm saying.
Well, she doesn't get, I mean, when she gets out, when she's out with people, she's either, you know, getting, you know, milkshakes thrown on her, or she's getting her hair, you know, just shaved off. And
Mike's the one guy that's not throwing milkshake and shaving her head.
Yeah, so for everything that Mike, you know, isn't, there's also some good things he's not as well.
Okay.
I mean, she's not doing great. You know.
All right, my recurring dream when I was a kid is really, really short and sweet here. There was an old-timey, like, 1930s movie villain with, like, a mustache that kind of curled up at the ends. And he tied me to the top of a ladder.
Oh, my.
And then he kicked the ladder out. And I was falling, tied to a ladder, falling toward the surface of a lake. And I knew that if I hit the surface, I was going to die.
Whoa.
And I never hit the surface. But I had that dream over and over again.
Wow.
So both of us kind of had a media... I guess media impressions, because you had you had a horror movie impression, right?
That I had never seen, right?
And my villain was like out of a silent film or something.
Yeah.
Huh. I was thinking, you tell me what you think about this. I was thinking we should split up the next episode into a two-parter.
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, there's obviously a lot going on in there. I mean, there's, it's longer than most long movies.
We'll figure this thing out. Anyway, you can look forward to two more Perfect Stranger Things episodes to finish off this season for sure. Looking forward to it. And
sleep well.
Sweet dreams.